Hello, I'm Michael Hainsworth. Ottawa's announcement of a net zero economic plan includes more than $160 billion in investments. It's a significant milestone in the country's commitment to addressing climate change. Much of it is tied to $93 billion in economic investment tax credits by 2035. But will the investment come? Canada's net zero economy only saw $14 billion in investments last year. Are Canadians ready to pay for net zero? Meet AJ Golding, a principal at London Economics International and an adjunct assistant professor at Columbia University. And this is Nick Nanos, the chief data scientist and founder at Nanos Research and an adjunct research professor at Carleton University. They join us now with their perspectives on the answer. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much for having me.
AJ, let's start with you. Where is public support currently for emissions reducing measures?
Well, that's a good question. I wouldn't want to step into Nick's field here, but what I would suggest is that we can segment the public between those for whom climate change is their abiding passion, and they believe that effectively whatever it takes is what we should spend. And then I would argue that there's another likely larger set of folks for whom climate is important, but is one of many priorities, and that the day-to-day realities of their lives bring forth a variety of concerns about healthcare costs, housing costs, education, that they likely rank of equal importance. Of course, we also have some folks for whom the climate is not a major concern. But I think that the biggest challenge in addressing climate change is making sure that those who are intensely committed understand that there is a mass of the population that includes other priorities as they think about politics and as they think about their own pocketbooks.
Well, you know, it's interesting, you know, in research that we've done with the University of Ottawa, the Positive Energy Initiative, we basically asked about, you know, meeting these targets and what it means. About 42% of Canadians actually think that we should be ahead of other countries, 40% on the same, about at the same pace. And, you know, the rest are okay with being behind. But what we're seeing here, and this speaks to AJ's point, a collision between environmental aspirations, and why don't we just say it, paying for the groceries and paying for the rent or housing. And Canadians are cross-pressured. They know that we need to do something on the environment. They're concerned, you know, not necessarily about the pace, but the cost, to AJ's point, and how that will work. And you know what? In this particular environment where people are worried about the cost of housing, worried about paying for the groceries, you know, it just makes for a situation that is much more volatile in the past. And people want to know how much it's going to cost. Like, really. And you know, the other thing that we need, AJ and Michael, I'm not sure what you guys think, but, you know, people want to be told, you know, when they're told that there's no cost, you know, like kind of like the carbon tax, like, don't worry, you'll get a rebate. They get suspicious, right? When stuff like that happens. And the reality is, they're going to need to be sacrifices in terms of not just consumption, but, you know, also in terms of cost and how we change our lives.
You referenced specifically the idea that people are having to decide whether or not to focus on the environment or feeding their children.
Yep.
That feels, because of the whole inflationary component to the Ukraine war, as well as COVID-19, a relatively recent phenomenon. Nick, has public support devolved over time?
Yeah, actually. Well, people are just starting to ask more questions, right? Basically, when it comes to stuff like this. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, the federal Liberal government has put its shoulder to the wheel on the carbon tax. And as a result, people see that at the pump. They see that on their bills for heating their home. And they understand that when something like that happens, it has an impact all the way through on the cost to transport food, all the way through all different parts of the economy. And you know, this has been especially true since interest rates have gone up. And you know what? It's like all the bills are on the radar. Why are they going up? You know, how are things going to change? And you know, I would hazard to say, Michael, that you know, basically in the last 2 years, as interest rates have gone up, everybody's checking their bills a little more thoroughly, and everybody's questioning what are the cost drivers for a lot of the things that people really don't have very much of a choice to in terms of needing to get through with their day-to-day lives.
I think it's unfortunate that, you know, the concepts of, you know, carbon tax, carbon cap and trade have become sort of the third rail of politics in Canada, as previously they had been, you know, for a long time in the U.S. And Australia. And I think the messaging around the carbon tax has been suboptimal. to try and use
the very kind word. AJ, suboptimal. I think the Liberals even said that was they were more harsh on their own messaging. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, well, I mean, it frustrates me that there wasn't any foresight as to what would happen when you gave waivers to one part of the country and you know, not other parts of the country with regards to things like the cost of heating. The challenge is that, unfortunately, while over the long run, proper carbon pricing likely reduces the cost of adapting to climate change and helping to prevent climate change, it seems like we're going to be moving away from that and relying more on a traditional regulatory approach, which tends to be more opaque, only catches the attention of those industries that are being regulated rather than potentially having other participants in other industries who find the low-hanging fruit. So I am quite concerned about the fact that carbon pricing is rapidly going out of favor here in Canada, because over the long run, it has cost implications. Over the short run, it may yield political benefits to bash the tax.
But don't you think part of the issue is that the government is trying to pick winners and losers when there are two other things that we need to address? First of all, technology, right? I remember I was at a briefing at the International Energy Agency, and I saw carbon consumption go down. And I kind of remember going to the economist, hey, what's up with that? And they said, well, that's when California introduced their more fuel-efficient car stuff that everybody started adopting. And that, you know, should we be spending more money and resources on things like that, which we are seeing in Europe, focusing on how can we be better energy consumers and telling people, yeah, there's going to be taxes, there's going to be a financial sacrifice, but one of the things you can do is try to consume less. And you know what? I can tell, AJ, looking at you and Michael, I remember growing up when people, you know, the parents used to say, turn off the lights, conserve electricity.
Jimmy Jewell. You remember Jimmy Jewell?
Do we ever talk about that anymore? Right? Like just basically trying to consume less, not necessarily just switching, because it seems like the government, especially the Liberal government, is focused on changing energy as opposed to changing energy behavior. And I think changing energy behavior, I think, is a sweet spot because, you know, this will be my last point on this, because you can tell people, hey, you know what? If you consume less energy because you watch what you consume, you save money, right?
Yeah, but then you drive past a corporate operation that has every single light on in all 16 stories at 3 a.m. It feels like we're putting so much pressure on the Canadian public to be responsible for being more efficient energy-wise and consuming less of it, when we could easily have asked that building to turn off the lights.
Well, I'm more a fan of providing economic signals for conservation. And I do think that there is a flip side. You know, at a time when we want our downtowns to be livable, we want to promote good behavior from amongst the folks that are there at all hours. I'm not convinced that telling everybody to turn the lights off is going to improve well-being. And
Let's step back then and expand this into a bigger conversation, more focused on that investment component. Because we know, for example, Honda is building a $15 billion electric vehicle battery-related plant in Alliston, next to a plant that will be retooled to make EVs. Canadian taxpayers paid one-third of that $15 billion cost. Is that a reasonable ratio?
So my starting point is always, show me the numbers. Right? Show me that you actually did the analysis in terms of the return on this investment of taxpayer money. And this is not a knock on any particular party, any particular government, because I think it extends across governments here in Ontario. I have not seen the analysis that would say, look, this is the right number to spend, this is the right sector to spend it in, and these are the spin-offs, right? When you see that analysis, you can start arguing about the assumptions, but at least you know that folks have done their due diligence. I sometimes feel like this is, you know, Bob's bargain lot, and, you know, whoever comes in with the, you know, biggest offer gets the car, right? And yep. So, you know, we are competing against the U.S., against Europe, in ways that may not be sensible, right? It's not clear that the U.S. and Europe are going to get a fantastic return on the investments that they're making, but I would like to be convinced that what Ontario is doing was done with some understanding of what the return on that investment is going to be and what we're crowding out, right? Are there niches where we could have gotten more bang for the buck by investing a similar amount of taxpayers' money than doing the same thing as folks that are much larger that have greater resources?
Yeah, and look, these are the types of jobs that we want. But you know what? I think if you calculated, AJ, the dollar per job created, it'd be a pretty dismally sad number in terms of the money that the government is putting up. My issue is that I think for average Canadians, they wonder, is like, where does it stop? Like, how can we say no to anybody else after we started entering into these types of relationships? And, you know, at what point does it not make sense? And, you know, there have been other, you know, and one of the challenges with these discussions, it's kind of like, what if, you know, so what if the government had taken this same investment or scope of investment and instead of, you know, one or two plants had invested a little more strategically to help 100 organizations, right, be innovative in this space? It's hard to kind of get into those types of discussions, but I think the reality is that, is it sustainable as a long-term industrial policy? No. So if it's not sustainable as a long-term industrial policy, why are we doing this?
So then let's bring it back to this question of how much do Canadians have to bear the cost of net zero versus incentivizing investment?
I think it has to be both, because ultimately incentivizing investment isn't a costless exercise. And these are foregone tax payments that ultimately mean that the rest of us need to pay more in taxes. And so I wouldn't necessarily put those in two separate buckets. I would say there is a cost. I'm not convinced that a green industrial policy is actually a climate change policy. If we were trying to attribute tons of CO2 avoided by making investments in battery manufacturing, I think you'd have a hard time doing that. And so for me, I think that we're playing catch up when we ought to be taking a hard look at some of the challenges that the Canadian economy faces in terms of relative productivity, in terms of skills matching, and use those as a means of promoting industry rather than throwing money at whatever the Americans are doing.
Nick, AJ brings up an interesting point. Are different measures more popular with the public? Clearly, it's not the carbon tax, even though they're getting that tax back.
Yeah, you know what, Michael? Whenever we ask people about what's more popular than the other, at the very top of the list, it's like someone else paying. And it's just not realistic. You know, like in polling that we've done in the past, Canadians say that they would like companies to bear the cost of, all the costs of kind of hitting these net zero stuff. When the reality is that there's no free ride. And I think that's what's missing here, is, you know, governments telling citizens and companies there's no free ride on this, and that there is going to be a cost if we want to achieve these objectives. You know, I think the caveat is that fewer and fewer Canadians believe that we can meet these objectives because they sound so ambitious. And how are we going to change in such a short period of time? And it undermines confidence in the system when governments always have to kick the can on, you know, what's the net zero target, you know, 2030, 2040, 2050, and what's involved in stuff like that.
One of the things that always bothers me when people say, well, companies should pay, is that there's a massive disconnect in the understanding that when companies pay, we pay.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are all, you know, through our pension funds, through, you know, the fact that we are employees, we are all connected to these companies. And so it's not you go and say, well, you know what, Brookfield should pay all of this. Well, you know, I bet we would be hard-pressed to find folks that didn't have some connection to Brookfield through some kind of a pension fund or other. And I don't mean to be picking on Brookfield. That was just, you know, the first name that came to mind. But we're all connected to the broader economy. And saying companies should pay simply means, you know, fewer dividends, lower stock appreciation, less available to pay wages. We can't pretend that we're not paying just because we've said we're going to put the tax on companies.
The other challenge is that if we're really serious about this, we would need to have some sort of political consensus on a long-term strategy. There's no short-term fix on any of this stuff. And, you know,
but can you have a political group come together in the age of social media trolling?
No. Yeah, we'd have to turn off Twitter and then bring AJ into the room, I think, in order to get something done. And, you know, there's two parties that have the best chance to win, form a government federally, the Liberals and the Conservatives. There would have to be some sort of, and, you know, consensus is the wrong word, but an understanding that, you know, that there could be some consistency over time. Because part of the problem is, you know, even if one government introduced investments or a regulatory environment, businesses need long-term stability to make long-term investments. The last thing that you need is the view that our policy or strategy related to achieving net zero could change, because that's a disincentive for companies to be in Canada and to invest in stuff like that, because there's no regulatory or policy certainty. And, you know, I don't know whether that's feasible or not, but I think if you're the CEO of a major firm, you're thinking, okay, so if we're going to invest, we need to make sure that there's some sort of certainty so that we can make those decisions, long-term decisions.
I will leave you with this, and I would love to get each of you to give me your reaction to this. Maybe this is a social media clip at the end of the day. The author Kurt Vonnegut is quoted as saying, and I'll paraphrase, that this will be the first time a civilization dies because saving it wasn't cost effective. Thoughts?
Yeah, we're the frog boiling in the little pot of water, Michael. We won't know till it's too late that it's too late.
I think that my concerns about civilization dying are somewhat more immediate, in that, you know, if we don't figure out a way to make our politics work, then, you know, when we think about talking about 2050 targets or 2060 targets for something like climate change, when we have real challenges with regard to social cohesion today, I would say the most cost-effective thing that we can do for the economy writ large is to figure out how to make our politics work, how to remember that a compromise requires both sides giving up something, that, you know, absolutism often results in nothing for everybody. So I think that we need to look more holistically across a range of issues in order for us to have a vibrant civilization.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time and your insight today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
A.J. Golding is a principal at London Economics International and an adjunct assistant professor at Columbia University. Nick Nanos is the chief data scientist and founder at Nanos Research and an adjunct research professor at Carleton University. I'm Michael Hainsworth. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the C.D. Howe Institute podcast with Michael Hainsworth. Subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. The C.D. Howe Institute is an independent, not-for-profit research institute whose mission is to raise living standards by fostering economically sound public policies. The Institute is widely considered to be Canada's most influential think tank and a trusted source of essential policy intelligence, distinguished by nonpartisan, evidence-based research and subject to definitive expert review. Visit cdhowe.org and follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn. Thank you.